Hey, welcome to each of you. This is Dave. How are you?
Hi, Dave. It's Pat. Great. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Yeah, let's do a brief check-in for who's here actually before the top of the hour, the early birds. Thank you, Pat, for your questions and the proposal of the vignette. I think you're first in the queue, actually, so we'll address your questions. I'm also curious about who are the other early birds here. I know there are a number of people have indicated they're going to be here, but who else is here?
Hi, Dave. It's Phil Giordano.
Chancellor.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear both of you speaking at the same time. So, do it again. The one on the left.
John Chancellor.
Hey, John. Welcome. How are you?
Doing great. How about you?
Great. Can you get a little closer to your microphone? Especially
Sorry.
If we're going to do a vignette.
Is that better?
No.
It's a headset, and it's as close as I can get.
Actually, okay, that's okay. That's going to work. And who else at the same? Welcome, John. It's great. We haven't talked in a long time. Who else spoke at the same time as John?
It's Phil Giordano.
Hey, Phil. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Great. Congratulations on your upcoming book. How's that? How's that going?
It's got out of the first or the copy edit came back last week, so now we're kind of proofreading, and hopefully that will be sent out to my other reviewers by Friday or Monday at the latest. And it looks like we're on track for the September 17th publishing. So.
Wow, that's great. That's the deliberate practice of publishing. You know, keep doing it, hone it, get expert advice, move on. That's great.
Thanks.
Be eager to hear how that goes. Anybody else already arrived?
Who Hi, Dave. It's Deb Puri.
Deb, hey, welcome. That's great.
Hi.
It's been a long time since we've actually talked.
It has been a long time. It certainly has. This has been great.
With what I hear about you, about all the applications of coaching, rumors precede you.
Yes, well, I certainly appreciate and remember so much of your great teaching in life coaching school. I've done 3 certifications since, and I know Laura's probably told you I'm writing and teaching, and I just got done teaching a class with like 68 people, and I do neuroscience of change and all sorts of things, and a lot of it, you know, I've learned from you, so it's great.
That's great. Oh, and by the way, I've changed my mind since we last talked.
Okay.
Stay tuned. No, that's great. That's impressive with the applications and the synthesis and integration of that.
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of different, I'm a health coach, so I do health coaching, and I'm able to integrate it all, which is fantastic, and I work with money managers. So it's really a really interesting niche. So this has been great. I really have enjoyed this.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you could join. Anybody else want to check in very quickly before we move into questions and interactions and hearing different ideas about things? Any other check-ins? Okay, well, and for those who have already checked in, Pat, you were first up. You had a couple of questions and a vignette, and I know John has sent in questions and vignette, and I have some others that I want to get to, but I mostly want this to be interactive, and, you know, I don't have anything prepared other than just to respond and have a discussion and hopefully illuminate or clarify or amplify some of what we've been talking about, maybe apply it in a better way or a more specific way to your approaches and your needs. And two things as we have our discussion, and I think these will be important in your coaching. One is to, whenever you do a laser coaching vignette, to do maybe a 2 or 3 sentence summary to set it up and frame it, and then a sentence to focus our discussion. Here's the importance of framework. Whenever you explain something or try to remember information, provide a context first. There was a classic study of giving three groups of people detailed information, and they were studied for how many things they remembered. One group, given no context, remembered three things. Group two, given a sample context, just a framework about what the information was about. In this classic study, it was washing clothes. And another group was given the context after they were given all the information in their sentences. So the group who is given the context remembered twice as many items. Their memory and their retention and understanding increased 50% just having one sentence about a framework, how to fit it together and create a story of remembering it. Saying what it was about after it was presented was no better than not knowing, because they couldn't, you know, recreate it. So that's the importance of framework. And something we didn't talk about in the seminars, a buddy of mine named Mark Waldman has done some neuroscience compilation of basically conversational intelligence. What he's done is to study the attention and retention of what people really get. And the example here is his 10-10 principle. If you put up 10 fingers or 10 digits and you put one up and from that fist, two fists of each word you say, and you stop at 10, and then the other person responds, there will be significantly better retention and understanding, because we tend to think in chunks of 10 to 12 words at most. After that, we begin to tail off a little bit. So that gives rise or dovetails with the principle in writing of clarity, brevity, and simplicity. And that has an application in coaching, to ask a client a question that's simple, specific, and clear, 10 words or less. And that applies to everybody except me, because my usual sentence is about 247. That they will get that in a better way. What he found, what Mark found, and this was at Loyola Marymount, the MBA program, what he found was that when people in emotionally charged and especially contentious situations agree to stick to this framework, like divorce, like mediation, various things that were important and emotionally charged, that people came to a resolution in 20 to 30% of the usual time, and they were significantly more satisfied with the resolution when they did it in this way. So that's the preface to Let's Talk Now. And Pat, would you present your questions or question to the group, and then whoever would like to respond in addition to or alongside me, go for it. Pat, go ahead.
Certainly. All right, thank you. To give it context, what this vignette describes is what I struggle with personally, and so do some of my coaching clients. The vignette is...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Is this the vignette, or are these the questions?
I'm sorry. Did you want me to go ahead with the vignette, or...
No, I thought you were moving into the vignette. Question. Okay.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Could you send some great questions?
Oh, thank you. Okay. Is a dissociative state the same thing as a mind state, which, of course, is unconscious?
It is. Dissociation refers to the process of disconnection of two states being side by side, but not ultimately interacting in the fluid baton passing that we usually do from state to state. An example that I gave in the seminar is the rat with the amphetamine. That's a distinct state that there is no communication with other states. It's like a silo. And people who are dissociative often have distinct states with little communication or awareness from one state to another. But mostly states of mind can become conscious. And this is the use of the neural conditioning chart to be aware of emotional triggers, and that immediate change from just any awareness of the emotional trigger to that instant state change, so column two, where that entire content is part of the process of that state, and that state will never change, as we discussed. So to be aware of both the emotional trigger and the state change, the content of what you usually think about, the negative self-talk, the, you know, disconnected sense of anxiety or moving into symptoms to try to restore that, like symptomatic eating or anything, that awareness can help you immediately get grounded and centered and move into an optimum state when it's planned. So that's the hard work miracle of recognizing what neural conditioning is and how you can change neural conditioning, change the hardwiring of your brain, and that's a huge tool for peak performance. And think about an application here. Whenever, let's say, in a good example is an athlete because it's so visible, and deliberate practice consolidates memory and skill and manifests as behavior. So the result of a trained behavior is a default operation. An engram, E-N-G-R-A-M, is simply the whole organized memory around that. It's a practiced habit. So this chunking is coupled with a physical cue. For example, Jack Nicklaus did a quick head turn. A tongue click, Daniel Wolpert does that. Or the example I gave, the phrase of, "I got this," by Laurie Hernandez. So these athletes have learned to instantly boot up a state with a cue and engage an entire mindset and access to the skill acquisition in that mindset in an instant way, and to stay in that, to keep repeating that if there's any fading at all or any challenge. So this is what we do as mentor coaches, to look at how this process may emerge in the work with clients, if they maybe disconnect or need to connect more, or just in the reporting of it. Now, does that make sense in terms of your question?
Yes, absolutely. Because it seems to me that...
Can you get a little closer to your microphone or talk
yes.
a little louder? Thanks.
Yes. It's awesome that the neural conditioning chart, you know, can be used for most anything like this, like the eating disorders, or it seems like any other addiction. So it totally made sense, because it seems to me like the addictive eating or drinking alcohol, whatever someone does, if it doesn't matter. If they get into that disconnected sense of being and they learn how to use the neural conditioning chart, learn how to do
yes.
that, get a cue, then it doesn't matter. They don't have to heal that part, which you may never be able to, that mind state. They can just do something new. So,
yes, if you look at what the adaptive attempt is, if someone eats symptomatically, the adaptive attempt is to get grounded and centered again by eating, and it does it physiologically. In my earlier life, I had one of the first couple of major eating disorder treatment programs in the country, multi-specialty. And so I was able to ask this question of hundreds and hundreds of young women with bulimia. At what point in the process of systematic eating did your state change? And 100% of them said, just before the food ever touched my mouth. So they were aware of feeling disconnected or anxious or some other experience and state that they didn't like, but they didn't know how to get grounded and centered in a more adaptive way. So it was an attempted adaptive effort to eat, and it worked, even though it wasn't exactly the cause and effect they thought it was. But what they recognized then was that they had a process of having a very powerful mind, and food was only a prop. It was an unnecessary prop at that, so that we could look at a better way to do it without having to use food. And that's the whole process we've been talking about, including mindfulness meditation and the use of the neural conditioning chart to deconstruct that process to look at an emotional trigger, and instead of being stuck in that second column, including whatever behaviors are in, and the same for any other addictive process, by the way, you know, alcohol, drugs, then to get grounded and centered and move into an ideal behavior. Now, after a while, each process develops its own physiological components, and once you get habituated to something, that becomes another issue that has to be addressed. But this is the emotional component. Make sense, Pat, for your application?
Oh, it really does, yes. And is that a learned behavior, the eating or the drinking?
Yes.
The drink,
yes. At some point, these young women, let's say the limitless, stick with our sample here,
okay,
in the presence of a non-empathic or non-regulating parent who was not attuned, they learned to figure out a way to do it themselves. So, you know, some people move into activity, some people engage other people, and these individuals simply turned to eating because it worked. And so cause and effect seemed to be there. So everyone has a history of a relationship with food, and that has physiologically and psychologically worked. So I'm belaboring this a little bit, not that we even think about doing therapy, but to illustrate a point here of what we do as coaches, because we deal with now and next.
Yes.
So
and it's
I want to move on,
no
Pat,
blame.
To some other questions,
okay,
and we'll come back to your vignette. Okay, great. John, you had a question that you sent in. Would you offer that to the group now?
Sure. I primarily work with entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, as a coach, and it might often start out as I need to get better control of my business or something like that, and invariably the process moves to other issues. But oftentimes the client will come wanting a solution to, I need more clients, I need a better relationship with my spouse. They'll come focused on a symptom, and they're very reluctant to work on the underlying cause. They come with a wide array of excuses. They don't realize it, but they're being a victim. It's not my fault. Things are beyond my control. And my question was, either in applying the roadmap system or the other system that you suggested, if I try the roadmap, getting the client to accept that they have control, that to recognize that they're the author of their own story, getting them to accept and own is where I run into resistance. It's where I run into a roadblock, and some clients get very entrenched and will not accept or admit that. And my question is there any effective tools or techniques that you can share that would get them to own up to their being the author of their own story, their having ownership of things? Does that make sense?
That's a great question, and let's do in just a minute maybe a laser coaching vignette. You be your most entrenched client, and I'll be you. But let me preface that by saying, if they could admit their own story, they wouldn't need you.
I'm aware of that.
A psychosomatic patient coming to a doctor, if they could admit it's psychosomatic, they wouldn't need the doctor. So let's begin with that. So I don't think either you giving the answers or getting to the ultimate cause of the problem, I don't think either one will work. What we do in coaching is look at the choice architecture of this moment, of how they're creating a process. Now, what you're going to see, what you see, and you have vast experience with this, and think about if this really applies and makes sense to you. Your clients are going to tell you what's going on, but even more importantly, they're going to recreate it with you in the relationship, and this is where the change is going to occur when it's in vivo, when it comes alive in the process between the two of you, because it's no longer out there, it's no longer a theory, it's no longer fixed, it's dynamic, it's here and now, so therefore you have leverage. So there are two things that you, I believe, need to think about. One is creating a working alliance with somebody so that you can get away with saying anything you need to say. And there, I have a blog. I know you've read it because I remember you liked it. If anybody ever likes it, I remember saying what we need to say. And the other is if you approach someone initially when they talk about their difficulty and they can't get somebody to do something, the first thing to do, the before strategy and story, before we begin to coach on the usual things we talk about mentor coaching, the first thing to do is empathic resonance. I want each of you to draw a circle. I know many of you have done this before. Draw a circle on the page. Now, inside that circle, put a stick figure. That stick figure is your client. Outside the circle, whatever you say is not going to really be heard or work very well. Your challenge is to get inside the circle. Then you can go someplace new with that client. And the simplest way to get inside that circle is an empathic resonance with their situation, such as, you know, I hear how frustrating that is for you, because that's their experience and you're resonating with it. You're not asking them. You're moving into their right brain with them. You've moved into the circle. So then once you are together with them in that circle, then you can go someplace new together, but it's going to occur through the relationship and how it comes alive in the session itself. You know, having them do the roadmap is not going to work as an assignment. That initially for the kind of clients who are very bright, very savvy, very entrenched, that's going to have to be in the relationship. And one of the things I do, as you know, is to ask a client in the beginning, may I interrupt you at any point if I feel like it would be helpful for us to look at this together? And inevitably, everyone has given me, the only person who's never given me my permission to do that is my wife, who regularly, but also you want to be able to engage them by resonating with their experience and then co-creating something new. Because every client is going to show you exactly what it's like to be them. It's going to be recreated. So it's not resistance. If you think about it, it's the client, if you frame it as the client is doing the very best job possible of showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. So they want an answer. You know, I understand how frustrating it's been not to do that. What have you, you know, to engage that? Would you like to do a little vignette about that? Let you be the client, and
sure.
and give me a sentence or two about you, and then we start a session. And we'll do two or four minutes.
Sure. I work with so I'm taking on the role of a client. I work with relationship couples, and I want to grow my business, but that means I have to do a certain amount of marketing work, and every time I start that, I get overwhelmed with tension. The stress just becomes too great, and I can't do it.
Okay. Well, I hear how frustrating that must be to have that experience of stress that seems essentially paralyzing.
Well, I want to just go a little. It's actually more than stress. I get depressed. I get totally immobilized.
Okay. Have you had any times that have worked that you've been able to do it for a time?
I have, but then I was actually working with someone else.
Let me stop you at the have, if you're okay with that. What was your state of mind? What was your experience like when you did it? When you had a sense of flow and accomplishment?
I was working with a partner, and so I didn't, the full responsibility wasn't on me. I just worked with the clients. I didn't have to get the clients. So I had success, but I didn't have to do the marketing.
Okay.
And I don't know what it is, but it just, I get in a state of paralysis and I can't do anything.
So you get to the point, do you have a plan that's in place that's structured and doable stepwise that you get up to the point of taking the step and doing the plan and then stop, or do you not have a plan?
Oh, I have the plan. I have it.
Okay.
It's written out.
Right.
I have the plan.
Together.
I know what I'm supposed to do.
Let me interrupt you again. Let's look together at that instant when the instant you stop yourself, you have a plan, and you've decided to begin Friday at 8 o'clock in the morning, whenever you have a plan, when you stop yourself at that instant, what is your internal conversation? What are you saying to yourself?
It's not going to work.
Okay. Do you bargain with yourself to say, well, I'll start Tuesday, or do you defy your own authority to say, the hell with it, I'm going to do something else, or do you get scattered, or is the it's not going to work enough?
It's not going to work, so if I do it, it's going to confirm that I'm not good enough, that I'm not capable. It's not going to work. So I'm just afraid then to touch it.
Okay, so that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you stop yourself. What, at the instant before you say it's not going to work, what are you experiencing? Is it anxiety or what at that instant?
I think it's anxiety.
Okay.
I honestly think that I'm afraid that I'm going to be found out to be a fraud.
Okay. All right. What I'm going to propose to you is that all of that negative self-talk, it's not going to work, I'm going to be a fraud, I'm frail, all of that is in the time capsule that you enter instantly with a signal of some anxiety. So the key would be to look at the various things, and it sounds like there's a big one here, and that may be enough for right now, to look at the emotional trigger. And there may be something more specific than just the plan to do marketing, but to look at what the emotional trigger is, and then to really fill out the second column there of all the negative self-talk, so that as soon as you start that, the first words of the first phrase of the negative self-talk, you can recognize it, and instead of continuing in it and being stuck in that time capsule, to get grounded and centered, to have a way, using a mantra, the three-part cue, focus, and physiology, or a kind of mindfulness meditation, whatever seems to work, to get grounded and centered, and have pre-planned an ideal behavior. You may have that ideal behavior, but it may not be specific and stepwise enough. Now, here's where I'm gonna stop for a minute and sort of do a sidebar. One of the reasons that's very common for somebody to resist something is they don't know what specifically the next step is. They have an idea, marketing, you know, whatever, but what is the next specific step that they do? Do they begin to create some titles for a blog? You know, what do they do specifically that's doable so they can take one step and feel a progress? Now, here's a reference back to what we've talked about before. The two most powerful motivations that we have as humans, to seek pleasure and avoid pain. If you're avoiding pain, which it sounds like John's client is, the avoiding pain assumes some things that are very conscious. This is not unconscious. I'm afraid I'll fail. I'm afraid I'll humiliate myself. I'm afraid I'll, you know, all of that. So it makes sense to stop. If he's afraid of failing, if he's going to humiliate himself and put in all this time and work and effort and energy, it makes sense to stop. So the negative self-talk comes to be an effective way of stopping, but that's the result, not the cause. The cause was the signal of anxiety. The result is all this stuff that makes it make sense to stop, so it seems like the reason, but it's not. So here are two questions to ask your client at this point. If your client has a plan with a specific next step, a next best action for the next hour or the next morning, what would be the greater pleasure if you do proceed, and what's the greater pain if you don't proceed? Two separate questions. And then moving it from the abstraction of marketing to what's the next step? Do you need to get an IT person to configure your blog so all you do is write, and that's the next step? You know, so you have a sequence of simple steps. John, does that fit at all with
That's very good. The signal of the anxiety, and I do focus a lot on the next step because I realize that if you don't know specifically what the next step is, that is a reason for indecision. And yeah, I do focus on that with clients.
Yeah.
But the signaling the anxiety and getting them to focus on that as opposed to that's very helpful. Thank you.
So what I would include at some point, with more time than 3 minutes, always the first step is state comes before strategy and story. The state is to engage in or to get in the circle to resonate with the client's experience and state of mind. That's calming. That creates a collaborative alliance. That's what we talked about, remember, as the essence of conversational intelligence. The first few words are going to boot up a mindset that the entire remainder of the conversation is going to process in the brain of the recipient or the listener or the reader. And if it's a collaborative mindset, then it's going to boot up oxytocin, the neurochemical system of connection and bonding. So the idea, what is unique, in my view, for all the professions, coaching versus all the other professions, every other profession, doc, dentist, CPA, those are based on a collaborative model. A client brings you or a patient brings you a problem, you ask some questions, you tell the client what to do. We in mentor coaching have a collaborative model. So it's how we can collaboratively co-create something new. And, you know, I hear how frustrating that is, and you have done a really good job of portraying exactly the situation that you've created. Let's look at some possibilities. This is what we do. This is why we don't go back into problems and look at causes and dynamics and reasons and feelings and all that, because what we know from neuroscience now is every time you go back into a problem, it etches it further in the brain, which is why some people get stuck in therapy. What we do in a different way is to look at possibilities, at solutions. So one area of
David, it's Phil. Can I chime in for something with this?
Absolutely.
So John, I'm a leadership and communication coach here in Maine, and my clients are really across the country. And one of the things that I do is help people recognize their states of mind. And I take them through a very quick exercise to prove that you can change your state of mind very quickly. So if you're game for a second, John, I'd love to take you through this exercise.
Sure.
Are you sitting down?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So when you're sitting down, and if you were depressed, could you put your body in a position that would represent being depressed in your seat?
I'm not sure I could because I don't think I've ever been depressed. I tend to be
so,
high.
So let me change that.
I can
that
do
then.
The client. I think I can do the client.
Have you ever had the flu or a bad cold?
I've had a bad cold.
Okay, put your body in the position of what it's like if you have a bad cold while you're sitting in
okay.
a chair.
Okay.
Where is your eyesight when you're in
down.
That position? Down.
Down.
And what is your breathing like?
Probably shallow.
Probably shallow. Okay. And where do you think your energy level is?
Scale of 1 to 10, 4.
That's 4. Okay. Now, can you shift your body and be in a position of confidence and just be sitting in the chair like you have the highest confidence you've ever had in whatever situation you've ever had in your
sure.
life, sitting in that chair, high confidence?
Sure.
Where is your eyesight now?
Straightforward.
And where does your energy
shoulders
level?
Back, erect.
Breathe it in, full breath, kind of
yes.
chest pumped out?
Yes.
What's the difference between those two mindsets that you've seen? So I asked that question, and then I asked the question, if you were going to approach marketing, which mindset would you want to approach marketing with? And it's proved that...
Well, certainly the more successful, and approach anything with the more
okay.
successful.
So what changed between one mindset and the other in terms of physiology?
It was my approach. It was the way I was looking at the world.
Absolutely. So... that is a type of way of creating a mantra. So as you approach these other things that you need to change, again, it's just an exercise to help someone see the difference and prove that mindset can change quickly. It was just sitting here on the top of my tongue. I just thought I'd put
good.
It out there as a physical thing you can do over the phone with somebody.
Good.
And it sparks a conversation.
Thanks, Phil. That's very interesting and a very interesting application of your work, yeah. So here's just simply another way to think about some ways to engage in a collaborative mindset with a client. And this is appreciative inquiry is something that I'm sure you're all familiar with because it looks at possibilities rather than problems. If you ask about problems, you're going to boot up a problem-oriented mindset. If you ask about possibilities, you're going to boot up a different mindset. So if somebody's stuck, for example, here are some appreciative inquiry ways to both engage together and look at this. For if somebody's stuck, you know, I want to do this, but I'm stuck. Would we be able to observe your behavior and know exactly what you wanted? In other words, the we here, we are observing this now. We're not elaborating about feelings and problems, but what would we observe? Secondly, what behavior would demonstrate that you're acting to do that? Is there a component you could begin right now and get some traction? Can you describe how you'd feel if you did what you said you wanted to do? Remember, the reason that we do anything that we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. And the couple of questions, Emmett, what's the greater pain if you don't do what you need to do that you just described? What's the greater pleasure if you do what you need to do? Usually the trick is getting the shadow story of the assumptions that create the stopping and the greater pain make sense in some way, but more at an unconscious. This is straight up. This is right there. So again, asking the right question has more power than giving people the right answers, and appreciative inquiry can get you much better results than seeking and solving problems, because if you give an answer, you're ghostwriting the client's story, and you're doing something more important. You are creating a way of that client believing that you don't believe in them. You're creating a codependency, because the client presents a question, you give an answer, you're saying basically, I don't believe in you. That's the most important thing we can do for a client, is to believe in that client. I don't work with anybody in whom I don't believe. Think about the analogy here of when your child learned to tie his or her shoe. It would be a lot easier if you kept doing it, and it would take way less time. You wouldn't be late, but, you know, then first day of school, you're tying shoes. But instead, you've created a model of believing in that child. That belief, and remember I talked about belief, changes someone's state, and it reflects an accurate mirror of believing in the child. They'll come to believe in themselves, because one of the things clients may not have had early on or currently is an accurate mirror to reflect back all of them. Some of them have been looking in funhouse mirrors, or mirrors where part of it's blackened out. But you, as we are obligated as mentor coaches to be able to do exactly what we need to do for the success, the massive success of each client. So whatever it takes. John, thank you for doing that and putting that out there, and I hope this was helpful to you and to everyone.
Certainly helpful to me. Thank you.
To move, Pat, you had a vignette. Are there any other questions just briefly about any part of that before we do Pat's vignette? Okay. Okay, Pat, set us up for what you'd like to talk about.
Okay.
Or what we're going to do.
Okay. So just read that little part of the vignette?
Just give me a – you – okay, yeah, frame it, and then you be your client, and I'll be you.
Okay. This is about – it's a woman who experienced abuse and trauma as a child and as a young adult has a problem with emotional eating and with the weight and self-worth issues that go along with these experiences. Even though she's middle-aged now and has undergone therapy, she still finds herself automatically reverting back to emotional eating to cope with uncomfortable feelings of emotional pain or stress.
Okay. You know, that seems so similar to our example that, you know, rather than doing a vignette of he said, she said, what about the application? Does the application of the neural conditioning chart to get her to be aware in an empathic and collaborative way to get her to be aware of the emotional triggers, because it's the focus has been on food as the problem. The emotional trigger is the issue, and the state change is the problem. The food is the prompt in the process that's her viable and best way possible to get back grounded and centered, at least in this way of thinking about it. So I would suggest, if we were to do this in, you know, with more time, I would suggest setting aside 30, 45 minutes and getting really grounded and centered where you can think about the emotional triggers that trigger eating. Write down all those emotional triggers without them being triggering, without entering that state, but be in an observer position. Stay grounded and centered, and return to that and do it as often as you need to be sure that you remain as an observer so that you'll get some accurate information, because you're not accustomed to having the trigger happen and just thinking of it as a trigger and then seeing the unfolding state change as other than just an instant deal that you then couple with food.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely, because I was looking at one part of it when I need to be looking at, you know, what triggers and just to see how the process goes. Yes. That makes a lot of sense.
That person has had everyone in her life engage with her about food and eating. And that's the one thing that I really wouldn't talk about. Talk about everything except food and weight and eating, but talk about her experience and the triggers and the state change. And then, yeah, that results in food, but that's not the answer and it's not the problem.
Yes, that makes so much
sense.
And
you're co-creating a new story together.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember my example about how well does it work to give somebody answers. When somebody goes to a physician, they're in pain, someone's given a prescription. Less than 50% of them actually fill it. The ones who fill it, less than 50% actually take it as recommended. So even when somebody's very motivated, less than 1 in 4 actually follow advice, sometimes when their life depends on it. So that's not the answer. The first mistake may be assuming people are rational. Second mistake may be assuming that people are eager for change. Well, of course they're not. None of us want to change. We want other people to change. And the other mistake is assuming somebody knows things the way you know them, that they're going to choose what you choose. None of that's going to be the case. That's why it's a collaborative model together to move forward step by step.
Yes. Yes. I see that's the only way it's going to work. That's the only way it could work.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes, you know, for this broad or big change or decision, what's the first decision that's going to give you some practice? What's the most important piece of new behavior to establish in order to move forward, to shrink the change to the next step? This is why we have a map. This is what we do in coaching, among other things, to create a map together with the client's ideals and needs central to that, with their goals central to that. Because when you have a map, you know where you are. You know where you're going. You can measure progress along the way. You can tell what's the next step. You can also tell what's deter and distraction.
And it's exciting. The person gets the map. They get to decide where to go. It's not that the coach is telling them or anybody else is trying to tell them.
It's the client's
story.
Yes,
and that would be a...
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's where the roadmap is beneficial, I believe, whether that's to regulate states of mind or to create peak performance, is the roadmap is simply a way to deconstruct a story and to do that collaboratively to look at the elements to construct a new one or a revised one step by step because it incorporates the mind and brain sciences in the understanding of it.
Yes, I see the application. I see how different it is. Than where I was putting my focus.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. I'm glad it was helpful. And thanks for.
Thank you. It was.
Mentioning and highlighting that. Other thoughts or other questions about things that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, Dave. This is Phil. So.
Yeah. Hey.
You know, the whole premise of this seminar was stress mastery and peak performance. And what I took out of it was confidence is closely aligned or more closely aligned with success than almost anything
confidence
else.
Confidence more closely aligned with what?
With success.
Ah, yeah.
And I think you had at one point said it was closely aligned with success, more closely aligned than competence or expertise.
Exactly, yes.
And then, you know, looking at the characteristics of a optimal performer, confidence and positive expectation were one of the 5 pieces that go into that.
Yes.
So if I'm trying to help clients really get to peak performance and master stress, what do you do with their confidence story? I mean, do you deconstruct a confidence story in any way deliberately?
Okay, I think that's a good a really good question and way to think about it. Confidence is a state of mind. So a state of mind of confidence is a way to begin a new endeavor and to look at how to create that state of mind, to look at what they've done successfully, what their experience is, how to really understand that, and create ways to re-engage that state. Again, it's about state management. Go ahead. You had a question still?
No. So it's about state management.
Did I hear you say something?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Can you hear this better?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
So it's about state management, but, you know, also a automatic, I guess, software starts running in your mind, which plays all of your past associations with confidence in whatever context you are in. I'm kind of making this up as I go.
Yeah.
And to rewrite that state of mind to help someone get from mediocre performance to high performance, or someone get from low performance to mediocre to high. To me, there's a confidence story. There's a software that has to be rewritten. And how much time do you spend looking at that software versus just creating new software, I guess is the question.
Okay, well, I think I understand your question. I think it's both, but it has to begin with where someone is and specifically what their self-talk is, how they enter a state. If someone is creating a state that let me put this a different way. How they cue themselves to a state is important. And confidence can only be entered by being fully grounded and centered. And remember, we talked about if there are things that someone is doing in a way that is not working. For example, if they're experiencing anxiety and that anxiety then cues a whole state that their confidence is out the window, then I would look in the simplest way possible of that first step of the perception of anxiety and looking at reframing anxiety to opportunity or to possibility and looking at how they can recreate that. So this is a review of what we talked about in a way about self-directed neuroplasticity. Whenever someone has a trigger, has an entry into a state that's not productive, they need to address that so that they can enter that state and fully occupy it. So the four steps we talk about, really simply the three steps. One is when there's a deceptive brain message, like, you know, you can't do it, or, you know, I'm going to fail, or whatever the habit is, because the habit is wired in the brain. Whatever that message is that's not working, that automatically is booted up, immediately recognize it. And this is the R of the roadmap. Recognize it as an error message from your brain. So you're immediately framing it as not the accurate reading of the current situation, but this came from an earlier time and place. Recognize it as an error message from your brain. Reframe it from a false message to a directive for action. It doesn't mean you have to act on it. And then refocus your attention toward an activity or process that's productive rather than sustaining focus on the deceptive message. And then, you know, move through the road to the final step of programming new identity. Remember, this is what makes change permanent, is when the change and the transformation is really taken in as part of a new and evolving identity, because we always come back to our core identity. Whatever behavior we do, it's not going to be permanent change unless we integrate it as part of our identity. So if there are things that aren't working, and this is a way that self-directed neuroplasticity, you can change your brain. The error message, relabel it, reframe it, and refocus it. Those basic ways of doing it, and do it with your client in vivo so they'll know. This is not something you're doing as a presentation. You know, you've heard me say, if information were enough, a lot of things would be sufficient, or somebody could get all they need on the internet. That's why they need you to engage in this collaborative process to co-create it with them. Now, Phil, does that make sense in terms of your question?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. It's just getting that conversation to the point where the client can make those changes. Because what I'm finding is, as I go through processes with them, either confidence has been low and they haven't experienced what they need, you know, to really get to effortless high performance. They haven't had that experience in their life that they're recognizing. You know, I think they've all had it, but they don't recognize that they've ever been in a state of flow. I guess I incorporate a state of flow is when your confidence is high because you're not thinking about anything. You're just going and doing. It's trying to pull out there.
I don't think it's that all or nothing, because everybody's had some good experiences somewhere. So these are the
I agree. What I'm saying is many clients have the perception that they don't have
So
that piece because they can't see it.
So these are the questions I would ask about that, and I'm interrupting you because of time, because I really want to address it. I think it's a really important question. Describe a time that was a high point experience when you were most engaged and felt most alive and vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
Tell what you most value about yourself and your work. What are the core factors that give life to your organization or your work at its best?
Yeah.
Imagine yourself a year from now with everything you wished for. Describe that experience.
Mm-hmm.
What's the most important piece of new behavior to establish that you can begin today in order to move forward? What would demonstrate to yourself that you're moving forward? So state, in this sense, it's a conclusion that you reach. Everything happens within a state, but you have to get there and you have to recreate it and find a way to consistently recreate it. But that can be engaged and approached and determined by the factors that you can deconstruct how to get there. There's a process to get there and to recreate it, to enhance it, inhabit it, and know how to get there. This is what elite performers do. They know instantly how to call that state where that contains all of the performance memory, all of the deliberate practice. They can get in that state, and they will redo the cure trigger in order to stay in it and sustain it, whether it's a flow sport like basketball or an episodic sport like football, you know, play and then a play and then a play.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We've got maybe two, three minutes. Are there other questions or comments about anything we've talked about or haven't talked about? Questions I haven't answered.
Dave, I was just wondering, at the beginning of the call, they said it was going to be recorded. I know you had said it wasn't.
That was an automatic response. It's not supposed to be my Turbo Bridge automatically did it despite my deal.
Well, my question was, did you record it or not? Because I think it was a very valuable session.
I think it's recorded, but I promised not to send it because people were talking about individual stuff. So I'm gonna.
I was wondering if it would be available only to those that were on the call.
If you send me your email, I'll have my IT guy put it up.
Yeah, I would appreciate it. I don't know what
okay.
everybody else thinks.
Anybody who wants to get a copy of it, send me your email, and I'll send you a link to the recording. But I wanted to preserve the confidentiality and the privilege because I knew we were going to have some vignettes and that sort of thing. Is everybody who talked or gave a vignette okay with me sending it? If anybody's not, send me an email, okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine with it,
I certainly am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, great.
Dave, the last question I have for you is, have you gotten out what you needed to get out of this call for putting together the program you're putting together?
Well, you know, I wanted to do this for you guys. I didn't have any expectations. I had no idea
okay.
what kind. It's been helpful to me to see what's been of value, and I thank you very much for all of you and your emails and your follow-ups and feedback and that sort of thing. I wanted to see what kind of questions you have, what kind of things needed better or clearer or more extended explanations, because as you as I think I mentioned this at the beginning, I'm developing a training, a curriculum with seminars and a workbook at the NeuroMentor Peak Performance Institute to train peak performance coaches. So I'm at the beginning of that, and I'm putting together some things. This was the trial balloon to see what kind of things were of interest to you, if this was helpful to you, and I very much welcome your feedback. I'm in the beginning phase of this. It'll take me a while to do it, and I very much welcome your feedback. And if you found the exercises that I picked helpful to further that, so I'm very much interested in your feedback. As some of you know, I spend the entire month of September in an old, real restored home in a quiet part of the French Quarter writing, and I'm going to be doing this entirely during that time. I began it last September. I'll be continuing it this September. So I'm very much interested in your input.
Hi, Dave.
Yes.
Just a quick question. This is Marlene, and I'm calling to find out if there's if it's okay that we can connect with fellow students on the line just to do a collaboration of our own coaching practices. Is that possible?
Well, as with any teleconference, I don't give out other emails because I don't have permission.
Okay.
So if there's somebody you want to connect with, send me an email, and I'll ask that person if it's okay. But I don't want to give out. I don't have permission to give out emails, so I send blind copies. And there were a whole number of people here, so I certainly, and I do that for every teleseminar series or webinar series that I do is to preserve that confidentiality. So
yeah, and I totally respect that. I'm just wondering if maybe whoever wants to do that, we can send you an email and say, I am open to connecting to other students that were on this stress call. And then whoever offers that, if we could, you know, obviously exchange information. Because I've done that on other webinars, and and we've just sent in an authorization to say, yes, I'm definitely open to exchanging
good
information with other
fellow students. Good question. Great idea. Fire it away. And thanks, Marlene. Great to hear from you.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Super. Well, we're out of time. Thank you all so much for this and all the feedback and responses during the seminar itself, but especially for this. I hope it was valuable for you and really allowed you to think about and integrate some things, to talk about things that we didn't get a chance to talk about enough. You know, my favorite way of teaching and training is seminar, which is a lot more discussion than just giving a lot of information, but there's so much I wanted to share with you that I opted for the latter, and I know that didn't allow very much discussion, but it sounded like from some of you that it would be helpful to talk back and forth, and I truly wanted to hear from you and be of additional benefit, so I hope it did that. Thank you all, and if I can help you in any way ongoing, I hope you'll let me know. Thanks so much.
Thank you so
much. Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Absolutely. Bye now.